Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Unveiling, A Mother's Reflection on Murder, Grief, and Trial Life, by Ruth Markell. Narrated by Anne-Marie Lee. Introduction. By 6 a.m. on the morning of September 26, 2019, it was already 91 degrees, another hot and humid autumn day in Tallahassee, Florida. I was getting dressed to attend the trial of two of the people accused of killing my 41-year-old son, Dan Markell. Even though the weather was oppressive, I put on my usual business uniform of a black jacket and black pants. I glanced in the mirror. I looked the same as I have looked for the past 7 years, ever since Dan died. Haunted, defiant, devastated, battle-ready. I remembered I had taken a warm shawl with me to the courtroom, as the Leon County Courthouse is always frigid. I checked my reflection one last time and asked myself these questions. Will I be comfortable sitting for hours in these clothes? Do I look appropriate for the jury, for the media, for Dan? How am I going to react when I watch the defendants walk into the courtroom for the first time? How will I deal with reporters following my every move? How did we get here? Will Dan ever receive justice? At this moment, I don't have a clue. The unveiling references my lowest emotional moment, going with my family to the cemetery to see Dan's gravestone for the first time, 9 months after his death, and like the act of lifting the cloth that revealed the writing carved on his tombstone, this book will expose what it feels like to be living what I call the trial life. It is, in effect, a series of unveilings. To date, one defendant has turned state's evidence, cooperating in exchange for a lesser sentence. Another has been found guilty of committing Dan's murder and has received a life sentence without parole. He has lost the appeal of his verdict. A third is being retried in 2022 after a mistrial. Others who were once members of my own extended family have been allegedly implicated in the case, but have yet to be charged. With the many inevitable postponements on the way to these new proceedings and the likely appeals if there are guilty verdicts, my own life sentence offers no likelihood of parole. You might wonder if Dan may have done something to put himself in jeopardy. He didn't. My son was never involved in any criminal activity, and he didn't engage in dangerous behaviors or live recklessly. Instead, Dan was an upright, thoughtful citizen. He was a devoted father and a loving son. A dedicated, revered law professor, a prolific, well-known scholar, and a wonderful uncle, brother, and friend. He lived a law-abiding and productive life, dedicated to teaching and helping others. Dan himself was adamantly opposed to the death penalty, a view he addressed strongly and repeatedly in his work. He favored the justice of legal retribution. His death was felt by people in far-flung places around the world, and for those of us closest to him, it brought life's normal progression to a complete stop. There is so much I have learned to lean on to survive my new shadow existence of what is trial life. My book will delve into the extreme juggling act my family and I have been obliged to perform while grieving a terrible and violent loss. Each chapter will describe my experience, from learning about Dan's murder to the pre-trial experience and our days in and out of the courtroom as the case wound its way through the criminal justice system. I have learned a great deal about the machinations of a murder case, the elements that the families of victims can bring to investigations and cases, and the very public and proactive roles thrust upon us as we seek justice. The financial and psychological burdens are staggering, shattering, irreversible, and permanent. Besides sharing my experience and knowledge for interested audiences as well as fellow victims' families, I also wrote this book to highlight the issues and problems surrounding the legal rights of grandparents in Florida. Until now, I haven't told my story, but I have decided to open up my life and my heart to describe the difficult moments that my family and I have experienced as we became connected to one of the most notorious crime stories of the past decade. In the following chapters, I will give the heart-wrenching details of the murder itself, as well as the trial of the killers. And beneath those headlines, I will also discuss what life has been like for me, the unimaginable experience of being the mother of a murder victim. As the evidence unfolded and we have moved forward in our quest for justice, I have learned extraordinary lessons and gained invaluable insights. Many have been rude awakenings. Others, as we found a community in our grief and advocacy, have offered unexpectedly beautiful and affirming moments. In this book, The Unveiling, A Mother's Reflection on Murder, Grief, and Trial Life, I hope to uncover and share hard-learned lessons which were imparted to me while waiting for hearings, trials, mistrials, and appeals. In addition to telling my and my family's story, I will write about my experience of the trial life to dispense any wisdom and insights I have gleaned along the way and to emphasize how people can show support and offer empathy to others left bereft. Helping living victims of violent crimes, or indeed anyone navigating the trials of life, including trauma of any kind, is a cherished goal of mine. I want to make sure that other grandparents do not find themselves in the same situation as I and Dan's father are, grieving the loss of contact with grandchildren. I want to inspire people to find a purpose in their lives and to use their grief and loss, however they show up and in whatever context, to make a real difference. And most importantly, I want to guarantee that Dan is never forgotten by his children, our family, the legal community, and the world at large. He contributed so much during his far too short time on Earth. Continuing to contribute even after his death would be very much in character for Daniel Eric Markell. Part 1. Disbelief. Chapter 1. The Murder. The revelation of Dan's shooting and the realization that I was now embarking on an entirely new and alien way of life. My son Dan and I had a ritual. He would call me in Toronto from his car while he was driving home from work. We would talk until he started pulling into the garage of his house in Tallahassee. "I'm almost there," he would say in a certain tone, a signal that we needed to wrap things up. Dan and I always had a lot to say to each other, but both of us were also efficient conversationalists. Usually upon entering the garage, he would say goodbye. We could always pick up our conversation another day. As a mother and son, we were very close, and he was called Danny when he grew up in Toronto. Starting when he left home for college at 18, Danny, who then preferred to be called Dan, would reach out to me to share his thoughts and experiences. Whether he was studying in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Cambridge, England, living in Israel, clerking for a judge in Arizona, working for a Washington, D.C. law firm, or teaching as a law professor in Florida, where he had settled with his wife and family, he always stayed in touch. When he traveled abroad, Dan would describe in animated detail the landmarks he had visited, the regional delicacies he had eaten, and the people he had met across North America, Europe, and the Middle East. From an early age, he sent his family and close friends long, long emails, which probably marked the beginning of his writing career. He kept us up to date on his latest paper to be published in a law review and on speeches he was making at criminal justice conferences about procedure, punitive damages, or the constitutionality of discretionary sentencing. I was always fascinated how Dan could express himself in a variety of styles. He was adept in academic and legal language, but he could also write in accessible prose. When he was just 12, we talked about his dreams of studying to be a rabbi. Later, he became interested in becoming a lawyer, or better yet, in bringing his combined skills in teaching, communication, and fundraising to the role of dean of a law school. Dan confided in me during the breakdown and eventual end of his marriage to Wendy Adelson, a fellow lawyer. He quelled with pride about his two little boys, Benjamin and Lincoln, and he let me in on his budding relationship with a new girlfriend, a professor at New York University in Manhattan. Usually when Dan called, I was at home in Toronto, not far from the house in North York where his father Phil and I had raised him and his older sister Shelley. Sometimes Dan would be driving home from the law school campus at Florida State University, FSU, after finishing a day of teaching criminal justice. Sometimes he'd be coming back from the gym. The only time he wouldn't call me was when he was alone in the car with the boys. He adored being with his sons and wanted to give them his undivided attention during every minute they shared. Even when I was visiting and the four of us were in the car together, Dan would shush me if I talked while the boys were speaking or listening to one of their CDs. "Wait," he would say to me, "we're coming up on Lincoln's favorite song." There was nothing unusual about the call he made to me on July 18, 2014. At first, anyway. I was in Montreal that day to celebrate my Uncle Lazar's 97th birthday. Lazar, my mother's brother, had taken a paternal role toward me after my own father died suddenly of a heart attack when I was only 9 years old. Single and childless at the time, he acted as a father to me and my older brother Bob for a good 15 years and only married once he was sure we were taken care of and happy. Lazar and I had planned a get-together with Bob, his wife Carolyn, and other friends to celebrate. His birthday party would be part of a kiddish luncheon the next day to be held after services at Lazar's synagogue. I had flown in early to spend some extra time with him and would be staying over with him and his caregiver Chris at his apartment. Soon after I got there, Dan called my cell phone to wish Uncle Lazar a happy birthday. He loved Lazar and often kept him apprised of his latest accomplishments. Then Dan asked to speak with me again. When Lazar handed me back the phone, I noticed that Dan's tone had changed. It was far less joyful. He was upset with his ex-wife Wendy, which wasn't unusual. After 7 years of marriage and the birth of their two sons, they had been through a contentious divorce that had been finalized a year earlier. Her desire to relocate from Tallahassee to Miami to be closer to her family was a long-standing issue between them. Dan had considered commuting or getting a different position at one of the universities in South Florida, but Miami was a 10-hour drive away, and the position he was interested in wasn't available there. In June 2013, Leon County Circuit Court Judge Barbara Hobbs denied Wendy's petition to allow her to move to Miami with the boys. The court ordered that the former wife, Wendy, did not meet the burden of proof that a relocation was in the best interest of the minor children. Once they had separated, it became clear that Dan and Wendy had very different parenting styles. For example, when it was Wendy's turn to have the children as part of their shared custody agreement, Dan would ask to speak to the boys by phone at night and would often go to their daycare center to have breakfast with them. But when Dan had the boys, he felt Wendy was unreachable. He would attempt to reach her so the boys could have contact when they were away for extended periods, but she was often unavailable. In addition to where they would live, another of Dan and Wendy's issues concerned the children's religious education. Dan was determined to raise them as traditional Jews who kept kosher and were educated in the faith. He was angry that Wendy had filled out an application for their oldest Benjamin to be enrolled in a non-denominational charter school kindergarten without consulting Dan first. He had a lot of questions about the education Benjamin would be receiving there, so the school had arranged a phone meeting between Dan and one of the teachers that morning, right after his conversation with me. That day, Dan had to cut our conversation short a few minutes earlier than usual before pulling up to his garage. "Ma, I have to take this call," he said. "Talk to you later." After Dan hung up, I left the apartment and spent the day crisscrossing town. Going back to Montreal has always been special for me, as the city is my childhood home. After my father died, my mother ran the family business, manufacturing ladies' clothing with her brothers, and we grew up among our extended family of cousins, aunts, and uncles. The joy of being raised this way is one of the reasons I believe in the value of close families, and Dan inherited this passion for family. Maybe it was one reason why he was so resistant to Wendy's wish to separate their own family. That afternoon, I had lunch with an old friend at a favorite bistro and made other brief visits. It was a joy to be in Montreal and reminisce. I made a few phone calls and went back to Lazar's before 5 p.m. to help set up for Shabbat dinner. It would just be the two of us, along with Chris, who wasn't Jewish but had learned the practices for Lazar's sake. At 5:30, even though the sun wouldn't be fully set for a few hours, we decided to light the candles and say the blessing early. Lazar didn't need a late night before his birthday celebration in the morning. Chris lit the candles and the three of us prayed together. Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu, melech haolam, asher kidshanu b'mitzvotav, vitzivanu lachadlik ner shel Shabbat. Blessed are you, Adonai, our God, sovereign of all, who hallows us with mitzvot, commanding us to kindle the light of Shabbat. The landline rang, and Chris went into the kitchen to answer it. "It's Phil," she called out to me. Phil, Dan's father, was calling from Colorado, where he was visiting friends. He was always concerned about my uncle, so that wasn't strange, but I was surprised that he wasn't calling my cell phone. Then I heard his voice. Normally more even-keeled, he sounded extremely tense.
"Are you sitting down?"
Phil asked.
"Go get a chair."
His voice was alarmed and very clear.
"Something terrible has happened."
He'd never spoken to me like this before. I did as he asked and sat down.
"Danny's been shot,"
Phil said in a shaky, frightened voice. I went completely numb and suddenly understood that phrase you always hear, an out-of-body experience. What I was feeling was completely real and completely unreal at the same time. The sensation I experienced as I heard Phil's words was terrifying and utterly alien. I felt as though a large sinkhole had started rupturing in the floor of the apartment and that some destructive force was pulling me toward the opening. It took all of my strength to keep from falling in.
"What do you mean?"
"I spoke with Dan this morning, and so did Lazar," I replied. "He told me that he would call me back, and he always does."
"He was shot in his car in the garage at his house a few hours ago,"
Phil said. Shot in his garage. Right after I spoke with him. Apparently, someone had followed him into the garage as he parked his car and fired at him twice. I needed to find him, to talk with him. I felt completely unmoored.
I needed Danny to tell me what happened.
How is he?
I asked. Why hasn't anybody called us until now?
This was so sudden.
Could it be a mistake?
Phil told me that the police had had a hard time finding us and only reached him by looking him up on Facebook. Then he told me that one of the bullets had lodged in Dan's brain. The friend Phil was staying with in Colorado was a doctor who told Phil right away that there was no chance that Dan would make it after sustaining that kind of injury. If Dan survived, he would be a vegetable.
Shooting. A vegetable.
Hearing those words made me think my whole world was turning upside down.
Chris came back into the kitchen. She had left while Phil and I were speaking. I don't know what my face looked like, but it must have been clear to her that something was terribly wrong. Dinner was ready on the dining room table, and the Shabbat candles lit, just as if it were a normal night. I left the kitchen and walked over to my uncle, who was sitting at the dining room table. At that moment, my task was one of the hardest things I ever had to do in my life. I had no idea how many more hard things I would soon have to do. I sat beside Lazar, put my hand on his shoulder, and leaned forward.
"Lazar," I said, "it's Danny. Danny's been shot in the head."
I couldn't bring myself to tell him that Danny was going to die. Uncle Lazar stared at me, taking in the news. He didn't say anything at first. Then he raised his fist slowly and slammed it on the table, laying it with an intensity that continues to burden my life in the most previously unimaginable ways to this very day. It was the force of a younger and very angry man, and a message that shook me.
Makatanam,
Lazar said in Yiddish.
Makatanam.
The in-laws, the in-laws. He was talking about the Adelsons, Wendy's family. I didn't want to encourage these accusatory thoughts of Lazar's. He was upset enough as it was, so I just sat with him quietly. I'm not sure if we ate or what we ate, but it was a very short and extremely solemn dinner. I felt as though I was moving in slow motion. All I could do was watch Chris as she passed food and cleared away the dishes. The phone rang again, and I got up from the table. The call was from Chabad Rabbi Schneer O'Reichman in Tallahassee, one of Dan's many rabbi friends. Somehow Dan's university colleagues and the authorities had been able to track him down, as well as other friends of Dan's earlier than they had reached Phil and me. The rabbi had been at the hospital, saying prayers over Dan to give him a Jewish version of last rites. The rabbi told me,
"The doctors said that Dan's not going to make it past 1 or 2 in the morning."
I couldn't believe it. It sounded so final. All I could do was wait for the phone call. Tallahassee was more than 1,400 miles away. I'd never be able to get to Florida by then. The rabbi put one of the ER doctors on the phone with me. The doctor explained that surgery was required to take out the bullet in his head. He said nothing about saving him. He didn't even put it out there as an option. I thought to myself, they don't perform unnecessary surgery on a patient who is certainly going to die unless they need evidence of foul play. This would be my first experience of evidence gathering, a process that would be part of the criminal exam and would continue from that day on. It was my first glimpse into the life that awaited me. In those first moments, I was already introduced to the language of criminal investigations. Now I had another reality to grapple with, not just the one of losing my son. This was the moment when I first realized that this was not the normal loss of a son, not a normal death,
Whatever can be considered normal in the face of such a tragedy, it could be a murder. This had never been part of my vocabulary. Who would think of murder? The sinkhole opened even wider, and my body felt as if it were falling and failing. Who would shoot Dan, my baby boy? He was the youngest, and I had a flashback of his childhood. In the flashback, Dan was 18 months old, running through the house with a mop and pail, his favored toddler toys. Now he was dying. I needed to tell other people what had happened. I don't know how I made it through those calls with Shelley and her husband Ian, or with my brother Bob and his wife Carolyn. When I reached her, she immediately started sobbing and hung up the phone. My numbness had started. Bob called back 5 minutes later and asked me, "Did you tell Lazar? Did he understand everything that you said? Did he understand that Dan was shot?" "Yes," I said flatly. "Unfortunately, he understood everything." For the next several hours, I paced up and down the main hallway of Lazar's apartment, from the front door to the master bedroom and back again. I couldn't stop. As I walked, I tried to look at the vivid Judaica paintings and evocative watercolors Lazar had collected on his visits to Israel and hung on the walls of his home, wondering if I would find solace or meaning in them. Instead, the shapes and colors blurred together, and my eyes refused to focus. My mind was trying to absorb what was happening, but I couldn't process the information. Danny, gone. That was unthinkable to me. This was too sudden. I was in a shock and a daze. In my work, in a crisis, I was always known as Ms. Fine. In fact, my predisposition to coolness in hot situations informed my career. I was an expert in emergency preparedness and disaster planning. My specialty was training and consulting with companies, schools, and houses of worship to deal with the potential of everything from fires to bomb threats. I had always relied on my hard-headed efficiency and problem-solving skills. But this was one emergency I was not prepared for. I couldn't think ahead to my next footstep, let alone any of the steps toward burying my son. At 2 a.m., the hospital called to say that Dan had passed away. The gunshot wounds were too severe for him to have any chance of recovery, and the hemorrhaging in his brain had proven fatal. I couldn't think or feel anything. I was frozen. I started packing to leave on the first flight out. Before being picked up at 6 a.m., I woke up my uncle to tell him that Dan was dead. Lazarus started shaking and crying uncontrollably. "Call me from Florida," he said, tears flooding his eyes. "I wish I could be there." As I looked at his stricken face, I realized that I still hadn't cried. The sight of Lazar shivering like that was awful. It has stayed with me ever since, and I will never get over it. This was the beginning of his undoing. I would soon lose my surrogate father Lazar and my son within 3 months. More devastation would enter my world. All I could do was concentrate on logistics and small tasks before me, one foot in front of the other. My son-in-law, Ian, had arranged for his father, who lives in Montreal, to take me to the airport. Ian had also booked my flights, met me at the Toronto Pearson Airport, brought me home to grab some clothes and my passport, and then drove me back to Pearson to meet Shelley and fly to Tallahassee. Ian stayed home in Toronto to take care of his and Shelley's 3 children. I was walking like a zombie, but Shelley had pulled herself together and was anticipating all that we needed to get done. Before we boarded the plane, she turned to me and said, "Mom, We had better call the synagogue people and Dan's friends to make a memorial for tomorrow. They'll want to do something. We have to give them at least a day to get it together.
Shelley was right. Dan belonged to Congregation Shamri Torah.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?